It's my pleasure to introduce Andrew Bocarsley. He's going to be talking on correcting our behavior, anthropomorphic atmospheric CO2, a defilement of the land. So, Andrew, please come on up.
You've got the people that were willing to sit around and wait. It's good. I had the honor and pleasure of giving a plenary talk at this meeting about 4 years ago. And so I'd like to do two things today. One is give you an update on our chemistry that I mentioned back then. And at that time, I related that chemistry to my faith and my faith walk. Today, I'd like to do something a little different and broaden that out, as you can see from the title, and ask the question corporately, kind of how are we dealing with this issue in light of biblical truth. So I'm an electrochemist. And I am interested in our laboratory and in a company that I co-founded in taking carbon dioxide, which I'm going to claim is a problem, and converting it into a useful chemical species. And the problem I claim is sort of shown right here. And I don't know if we can turn the front lights down.
This is middle switch.
Middle switch?
Middle? Ah, great. Okay, so on the left-hand side there is a coal-fired power plant. It's a 1 gigawatt plant, which is a big plant, but we have lots of them in the United States. And what you see coming out of that is water. All that white stuff coming out, right, from the burning of the coal. But there's an equal amount of CO2 coming out that you can't see. So you get a feel for how much it is. And it turns out that a plant that size, you're generating 1,000 pounds of CO2 per second, which is just a phenomenal amount. When you start thinking about what could I do with 1,000 pounds, by the time you thought about that, right, you've generated many thousand pounds more. So this is just a huge amount. In fact, when I heard that number, I said, I don't think you can do anything about it. It's just too big a number. But that's this one plant. If you look at a map of the United States, those are the coal-fired power plants in the United States. And if you find the ones that are these bigger green circles, those are the 1 gigawatt plants. The smallest plants are smaller circles. And you'll notice there's a lot of them. In fact, there's plants that are even bigger than 1 gigawatt, like that big red one down there. So this is like the tip of the iceberg. It's a huge amount of carbon dioxide that we're generating. And our climatologist colleagues tell us that is a problem. So I want to bring up two questions to think about. And that is, I'm just going to say that it's bad for the environment. Okay. Why do we think we can do that? What gives us the right to do this? Why do we think we can get away with this? We've been doing it for a long time, so apparently we as a society think it's not a problem, we can get away with this. And then is it possible that we're doing it because we're just going to claim ignorance of the problem, which is often misstated is the case? So let's start with that first question. So the first question I have, actually, I put this in because Terry asked a question, made a comment yesterday when my wife was talking about environmental stewardship. And in Genesis 9, the Lord is talking to Noah after the flood, Noah and his sons, and he tells them that not only be fruitful and multiply, but the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, goes on, lists them, and into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. As I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. So, do we have the right to do things that are environmentally going to change the environment significantly? Yes, apparently. Noah's given the authority to do that. Now, is it a wise thing to do or a smart thing to do? That's a different question. But we're given the right to tinker with the environment, I would say, for better or worse. And so if there's a particularly, this came up in the context yesterday of mosquitoes that are carrying nasty viruses around. Can we wipe them out? And this would suggest, although it's talking about food here, that yeah, because the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon all beasts. Okay, now on the other hand, to take a little more balanced view of this, let's go a little bit later in time to the prophet Jeremiah. And he reminds Israel that the Lord said, I brought you into a plentiful land to enjoy its fruits and its good things. But when you came in, you defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination. So we might have the right to do that. We're given the opportunity to defile the land. And, of course, that means a lot of things besides ecology issues. But certainly that must be one of them. But we can see that when we do that, when
we don't carry out our obligation in carrying out our dominion, God is not happy. And in fact, two verses later, things get a little bit more heavy-weighted in that the Lord says that, I still contend with you, and he's referring back to this problem, and with your children's children I will contend. So in other words, we make a mistake, and I think we know this, right? It's not only our children, but it's our grandchildren that are going to be paying for that mistake also. And Pat and I became grandparents 2 years ago. That's a much more serious issue for me these days. But it's a long-standing problem. So yes, we have authority over nature, but we also have an obligation to steward nature. Okay, so why if CO2 is a problem and if it's changing our environment in negative ways, why can we get away with it? I want to go back to that question. Why do we think we can get away with it? And I think part of the problem is human nature, and that is if there's an immediate effect associated with something we do, we respond immediately. So if I tell you, you're going to take one more step, you're going to fall off a cliff, then there's a really great chance you will not take that step. If I tell you, on the other hand, something you do today will impact you in a negative way 50 years from now, you might say, well, let someone worry about that 20 years from now, maybe 30 years from now, somewhere down the line. We'll take care of that. We don't have to worry about that today. And we certainly think that way, and our government thinks that way in general. And this is the situation with the whole issue of greenhouse gases and climate change. It is a problem down the road. And so we kind of say, we'll worry about it later. I think that's part of the answer. It's a scary problem in that sense, though, that if you think about what you have to do so you can avoid this effect, in the case of greenhouse gases, if you don't start somewhere around right now, then you're not going to be able to fix this. So in other words, if you come from New Jersey, where we live, and you're at Princeton, which is on the eastern part of the state, and it's a whole 33 feet above sea level, where our house is, if you wait until the ocean invades New Jersey because of climate warming and it's 32 feet higher than it is today, there's not much you're going to do about it at that point. So we have to take action now, and yet we're taking action for a future generation, and we tend to say, well, someone else can deal with that. That's one aspect. The other aspect, or a second aspect of this problem, I take this from this book by James Butler, is that the Lord's designed nature to be very forgiving. So there's a lot of feedback cycles and whatnot. This is the carbon cycle. So we're sitting here burning our coal. We're putting CO2 in the atmosphere, and of course we're doing that through other things besides burning coal. And the atmosphere can hold a certain amount of it without a problem. In fact, it's good that there's a certain amount in the atmosphere because we want a little bit of warming, maybe not quite as much as we've had this week, but we don't want it to be, below freezing here either, right? So that's all good. And then we have mechanisms for taking out of the atmosphere and, if you will, hiding it in places. Of course, making things like oil and coal, we can put an awful lot of it in the ocean. That's where most of it goes. And so you go and you put some CO2 into the atmosphere, and it turns out through all these mechanisms, only about half of it stays there. And so up to a point, you can do this, and there is no problem because the problem takes care of itself. And if you break this anywhere, then suddenly you have a big problem. It's not like it's just going to leak in, but you break the cycle, and now it no longer has all these feedback loops that take care of the CO2 for you. And you can break that cycle, this is one of my favorite freshman chemistry lectures, pretty easily by just putting too much CO2 into the air. And it has to do just with acid and base chemistry. It's the pH of the ocean that is sort of what controls all of this. Okay, so our kind of common observation is, oh, well, we can put the CO2 up there, and it's not a problem, because nature will take care of it. Okay, but we're getting to a point now where we're going to break that cycle if we're not careful. So that's why I think we have a behavior, those issues let us kind of get away with it, or think we can get away with it. Okay, now the other issue, can we claim ignorance? Is this a new problem? This idea of climate change and CO2 and greenhouse gases has been sort of at the forefront of political issues and international issues and in the newspapers and whatnot, I'd say since around 2000, more or less. So that's fairly recent, 16 years. But is it really a new issue? Well, those of you who took freshman chemistry may remember this gentleman down here, Arrhenius. His name comes up every time you teach freshman chemistry. He did a lot of things. He may have been arguably the first physical chemist we had. He was Swedish, and so he's also a member of the first Nobel Committee. And since he was Swedish, he wrote most of his papers not in English, right? But he came up with an interesting thought, which was that he could use a light from the moon to determine how much CO2 there was in our atmosphere. You have the moon in two different locations through the night. You make observations of this particular wavelengths of light where CO2 absorbs, and you can calculate how much was there. So he needed that data, that astronomical data. And that data was resident at that time in Philadelphia at the National Naval Observatory. So he jumped on a ship, came to the United States, and did a sabbatical type of thing in Philly. And because he was in the United States when he did this work in collaboration, although he published it in a British journal, he wrote the paper in English, which is very convenient because we can understand it easily. And so this paper, here's the title down here, on the influence of carbonic acid, that's his term for CO2 in the air, upon the temperature of the ground. Okay, and this paper, you'll notice, was published in April of 1896. And his big conclusion is that as we put more CO2 into the air, it's going to get warmer here on the ground. Okay, there it is, 1896. Very, very insightful. And he specifically says it's due to coal burning that this is going to happen. Okay, which of course was the major fuel in 1896. Specifically also says not only is coal doing this, but other things aren't doing it. These issues about, well, maybe there's a solar flare or something like that that's changing our temperatures. He rules that out in his discussion in this paper. And then he makes only one serious mistake in this paper, and he says, this is a good thing. Okay. He says, why is it a good thing? He goes, because as the human population grows, we will burn more coal, and things will get warmer, and that will make our overall land area more able, the agriculture, be more sustainable. We'll have more land that we can grow things on. He kind of forgot about the point that if someone... someplace gets a little warmer so that you can grow things there. Somewhere else gets really warm and you're not going to grow things there, right? So, but...
the Arctic Circle.
So. Yeah, we might be doing farming up in the Arctic Circle, but the equator isn't going to look so good. And he does not address the issue of maybe diseases might enjoy warmer climes and things like that. But he gets the physical science, he nails it. Okay, the life science part, maybe a little bit less. But there it is. Right there, and again, 1896. So we have known about this in the scientific literature for a long time. This is not the only paper. There weren't a lot back then, but people that have thought about this issue seriously realized it could be a problem. Let's go a little more recent. 1896 will make it for you. Something a little more recent. 1966. It's a little bit while before I was doing science. Two scientists working for the government, for OSHA, published this paper. This paper was the first digital model of the climate that actually worked. It was actually predictive of climate by Manabe and Weatherall. Dick was a member of our congregation, passed away a couple years ago. He figured out how you do the computer science correctly so you could have some reasonable predictions. And in this paper, right here in the abstract, according to our estimates, a doubling of CO2 content in the atmosphere has the effect of raising the temperature of the atmosphere about 2 degrees Celsius. So 1966, if you don't want 1896, 1966 we knew about. So this is not a problem that was just called to our attention in the year 2000 or somewhere around then. We've known this for a long, long time. So I don't think we can claim ignorance. I don't think we can say we need to study this problem some more. We've been studying it for a long time. It's time to say that we know what's happening. I think most climatologists agree with that statement at this point. It's been quite interesting because Dick, you'll work for the U.S. government, and depending which president was there, he's either allowed to or not allowed to publish this sort of stuff.
So have we doubled our CO2 since in the last 50 years?
We are coming up on 500 parts per million at this point. People said that 450 was a problem. So we haven't doubled our CO2, but have we doubled our temperatures? Yeah, we've more than doubled. Since 1900, the data I'm thinking about goes back to 1900. Since 1900, global average temperature has gone up about 6 degrees.
Pre-industrial CO2 was about 280.
Correct. That's right, 280. And we're bumping up against 500, which is sort of scary in that if you go back and look at all of the work that geologists have done on figuring out historical CO2 levels, and there's some errors in this and whatnot, but one thing that you can say with certainty is we have never been at this level of CO2 in our atmosphere, as far as we can tell, throughout the amount of time that geologists can look at this, which is something like 400,000 years. So about the best you can do is say we have embarked on an experiment which we don't know the answer to, okay, if you want to be a real optimist. And if you want to go with the literature that's available, you can say we kind of know the answer and it's not a good answer. Okay, just to bring us up to date, this just came out last week. So this, as we were coming here, this is a report out of NASA, who publishes pretty regular reports at this point, looking at the temperature, satellite measurements of the temperature. The statement is that this past June has been one of the warmest, it has been the warmest June on record since we've kept records on the topic. And what you see here is things in red are record temperature highs, and things in deep blue are record cold. And there is a little bit of blue there, you'll notice, deep blue right off the Antarctic. But there's a lot of red on this map, and not all of it's the warmest, but much warmer than average, you'll notice, is very high, and warmer than average, very high. Okay, and the near average is, there's some, but there's not a lot. So the Earth as a whole is definitely warming up. This is just for June. You have to look at more months than this. But this is comparing this June to last June, the June before, and I think there's 150 years of records in June that this is being compared to. So it's warm, in case you hadn't noticed. Yeah, and each year, you may notice, when they put out these reports, they say it's the warmest May or the warmest June on record. So we keep on going up. It's not an anomaly. Okay, so what do we do about it? That's the problem. That's where my research comes in. What we're interested in doing is taking that carbon dioxide and turning it into something that we can use, instead of just let it sit up there and keep us toasty. And I'm an electrochemist, so we're going to do that electrochemically. So we're going to build a little electrochemical cell here. And in this compartment, we're carrying out a reduction, the cathode compartment. In that compartment, we're going to take the CO2, which we bubble in there, so we have water in there. And we're going to bubble CO2 in, kind of seltzer, if you will. And we're going to, in this particular example, convert it into methanol. There's several compounds we can make, but methanol is a nice compound. In terms of being useful compound, both as a fuel and as a starting material for other organic compounds. And in the other compartment, we have to oxidize something, and in this example, I'm oxidizing water, making oxygen, because that kind of seems like a safe thing to do. And if you want to do this, it turns out there's a net energy requirement to doing this. It's uphill energetically quite a bit, so you need to put some energy in. That's going to be electricity. And the one thing you don't want to do if you're interested in getting rid of CO2 is use a fossil fuel to generate that electricity. So no coal-fired power plant, no gas-fired power plant, but we have, you know, something alternate, solar, wind. That's, for instance, a fusion reactor if you want to get very exotic. Or you can do fission also, right? We can use a regular nuclear reactor if you wish. So anything like that, just no fossil fuel involved. And then, of course, you have a net uptake of CO2, and you turn it into a useful compound. Okay, now let me put on my business hat instead of my chemistry hat for a moment, because I co-founded this little company that's trying to do this, and ask, well, what should we make if we can make different things? Is methanol, for example, which I just gave an example, the right thing to make? And so now we have to look at dollars and things like that instead of chemistry. And so we can make all these different compounds right here. There's 29 compounds that we've made, but let's limit it to these four for this discussion. And it takes different numbers of electrons to convert CO2 into these compounds. So we're taking CO2, an inexpensive material that we're trying to get rid of. We're taking water, which we like, but it's still an inexpensive material. And we're taking electrons, and we're going to convert it into these products. And the expensive reagent, if you will, here are the electrons. Electricity is the most expensive thing that we're going to put in there. So, for example, we can make methanol, like I just suggested. That's going to take 6 electrons to convert CO2 into methanol, one molecule of methanol. And we're going to be able to sell that for $400 per metric ton. And it turns out, you lose if you do that. That is, you've paid more for the electricity, basically, than you can sell it for. Okay, so that's not a great idea. So what you want to do is you want to make something that uses just a little bit of electricity and sells for a lot of money, right? And so you can see on this little chart, you either want to make formic acid or oxalic acid, which have nicer prices. And obviously you'd say, well, let's make oxalic acid, but it turns out, although that's something liquid light is doing, that there are some chemical complications to that. So what I'm going to tell you a little bit about today is making formic acid, because that you can do, and that's a winner also. And by the way, the other thing you have to do here is you have it sitting in that electrochemical cell after you made it, which is a cell that has water in it, it has some salt in it, and CO2, of course, so you didn't react. And you got to get it out of that and make it nice and pure to use it. So there's some other costs back here in terms of purifying it. We have to take that into account also. And if formic acid looks like a winner from all that point of view. Okay, so first thing, we need to build that electrochemical cell. And if you want to build an electrochemical cell, you need some electrodes. When I first started doing this and talking, people were talking about building a company. I said, you know, we know how to do this with platinum. And all the investors said, no, you don't. I said, no, I can do it really inexpensively with platinum. They said, no, don't even mention that. Okay. So a scientist by the name of Horry, back in the 80s, kind of did a whole survey of the periodic table and figured out, made all these electrodes out of these metals, and figured out what they made when you put them in a seltzer. And most of them are, the ones in red, make hydrogen. They don't touch the CO2. They just reduce water to hydrogen, which is not a bad thing to do, but not what we want to do here. There is a magic metal. It was discovered in the late 70s, which is copper, and there's a whole bunch of people doing research on that, so I try to stay away from that. But I'll point out to you, over here, there's a whole series of metals that all make formate, or formic acid, from CO2. And they're all clustered here together on the periodic table. And to a chemist, you know, when you see something clustered on the periodic table, that usually means there's some relationship there that you'd like to understand, that they have things in common. And so we've been focusing the last few years on these metals. Not so much that thallium one, because that's really toxic, but the rest of them. Okay. And indium right here has been one that has been particularly interesting and useful. And so we've looked at that indium, and we've... This is a slide that's supposed to convince you that we have studied that indium electrode extensively, right? So we've looked at it doing this CO2 to formic acid. We've looked at scanning electron micrographs of it, and we've looked at X-ray diffraction patterns of it, and there's some beautiful XPS data here. And the punchline to all of this is if you have a clean indium surface, which is what Horry in that last slide said is what you want, it doesn't work. It's not, the indium is not the catalyst for this reaction. But it turns out it's indium hydroxide that's the catalyst for this reaction. You need a thin layer of that on the surface. And this was very surprising to us because we operate at a potential when we're reducing CO2 to formate out here in this potential range, where according to thermodynamics, there should be no indium oxide or indium hydroxide on the surface. So this is a metastable species that's there. And we're pretty sure it's the right species because we've gone and we've synthesized nanoparticles of the various things that might be there and looked at them by, that's a high-resolution transmission electron micrographs and electron diffraction. We've looked at the products that come off the electrodes as we put these various species on the electrode surface. And we do a lot of in situ spectroscopy. This is IR spectroscopy. And what we see is that indium hydroxide, those three little peaks are important, that indium hydroxide over time while we're running this electrode gets converted into a carbonate species on the electrode surface. That is, that indium hydroxide that's in there reacts with the CO2 that's in the water. And it's that species that gets turned into formic acid. So that little middle peak is the magic peak there. and so now we know how this works, and we can build a nice electrode to make this work. And now we shift out of Princeton's labs, where all that work was done, and over to Liquid Light. And Liquid Light, I didn't show you our cell, but our cell is a little 50 milliliter, maybe a big day, 100 milliliter round bottom flask that we're using in our electrode size. If we make a big electrode, it'd be 2 square centimeters. A huge electrode for us, usually much smaller than that. This apparatus is about 6 feet by 6 feet. This is a bigger scale. Now, there's a lot of stuff going on here, but the business end of this apparatus is in that little red circle right there. There's the electrochemical cell. And the rest of it is supporting stuff that gets the electrolyte in there as a flow cell and gets the products out and keeps things pure and all that good stuff. That cell, though, that has 100 square centimeters of active surface area. So my 1 to 2 square centimeters goes up to 100 square centimeters now. And that's pre-commercial, but that design, it turns out, can be scaled up, whereas my little round bottom can't be. We have some electronics. And this particular cell that I'm showing you was set up to make that oxalate that I told you about was a good product. Okay, finish up. We're getting there. So we took that cell, we took 3 of them, made a stack of them, short stack, And those cells now are sitting out in the parking lot on Route 1 of Liquid Light, and all they're connected to is this commercially available photovoltaic. Okay, that's it. That's our one input. And we're bubbling CO2, aqueous CO2 through that cell, and we're monitoring the sunlight that's hitting the photovoltaic. Oh, a little cloud came by. Nice April day. Okay, and then we're also simultaneously monitoring the formic acid we're making. It exactly follows that. And in addition, you'll notice when there's no cloud around anyway, that, and I'm showing you, I must confess, the absolute best set of data that we ever got on this. We can make almost 3% conversion efficiency. To be honest, on average, we've got a lot of runs, it's about 1.8%, okay? That still is a good number because you can compare it to natural photosynthesis, what plants do. They turn CO2 into their products with 1% efficiency on this scale. So we've beat out the natural system on this quite convincingly. So we can do this, and we can do it efficiently. And in fact, since we published that data, some other people said, we did better than Bocarsley. So that's good. They've got it up to 4% on average. Okay, so just to finish up, going back to where I started, in Psalm 115, the heavens are the Lord's heavens, but the earth he has given to the children of man. So we have the earth. We can do with it, as I argued before, what we wish, but switching over to Revelation, we see that there is a day of judgment and that the Lord is very concerned about destroying the destroyers of the earth, which again has multiple meanings, but certainly our ecology is one aspect of that. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. And thank all the students for the work.
Stand up and state your question.
So in your apparatus, what you're bubbling through into the water, is that just atmospheric air?
No, we're bubbling pure CO2 through. Yeah, so there's an energy step that you have to collect the CO2 and bubble through. You know, but a coal-fired power plant, the output is 15% of the output of CO2. So actually that you could directly bubble through our cell.
So you would, can I just jump in on the question? So you would propose putting this kind of system at the stack of a...
Coal-fired power plant is a particularly challenging issue because, unfortunately, this other thing nasty is coming out of it besides CO2. So you have to do a little bit of cleanup. But if you go with a great source of CO2 is a cement factory. There's almost a pure stream of CO2 coming out of that.
They have one of those out on the hot.
Yeah, and that you could do because all you have to do is remove particulates. So just a little bit of filtering, or even better, if you're a biologist, a fermenter outputs a huge amount of aqueous CO2, this wet CO2, humidified CO2, and that would be great also.
Other questions?
Andy, I think I probably asked you about this before, but how does the electrochem methods compare to, say, high pressure gas phase,
So you could take CO2 plus hydrogen and do a more classic chemical reaction, and that is the competition. And so I'm going to tell you mine's better, of course, right? But, I think the jury is out on that, in that both systems have to be optimized, and we see which one wins. So far, numbers are better, but that may not be the end of the story.
Scalability? You think you can scale?
We're scalable, yeah. That design I showed you briefly is a scalable design. We've actually gone up to half square meter cells, and 1 square meter cells are commercial, so.
Thank our speaker.